This is Audible.
Blizzard Entertainment, Inc. presents Liberty's Crusade by Jeff Grubb, performed by Neil Kaplan. Acknowledgements. This novel is set in the heart of the StarCraft universe, which would not exist without the hard work of the talented designers, artists, and programmers at Blizzard Entertainment. Antebellum. The man in the tattered coat stands in a room of shadows, bathed in light. No, that is wrong. The figure is not illuminated by the light, but rather is light incarnate. Light folded and curved in on itself in a holographic replica of its originator. The man speaks to the dimly lit room, unknowing and uncaring if there is anyone present beyond the limits of his own radiance. Phantom smoke, equally luminous, snakes up from the cigarette in his left hand. He is a shard of the past, a bit of what had gone before frozen in light, playing to an unseen audience. "You know me," says the shining figure, pausing to take a drag on his coffin nail. "You've seen my face on the Universe News Network, and you've read the reports under my byline. Some of those were even written by me. Some others, well, let's say I have talented editors." The light-starred figure gives a tired, almost amused shrug. The recording presents him as a small mannequin, but he looks like, as if, in real life, he would be of normal height and proportions, if a little lanky. His shoulders slope slightly from exhaustion or age. His dirty blonde hair is spattered with lighter striations of gray and is swept back in a ponytail to hide an obvious bald spot. His face is worn, a bit craggier than would be permitted for a traditional newscast, but still recognizable. It remains a famous face, a comfortable face, a well-known face across human space, even in these later war-torn days. But it is his eyes that demand attention. They are deep-set, and even in the recording, seem to reach out. It is the eyes that create the illusion that the shining figure can truly see his audience and see them to the core of their beings. That has always been his talent, connecting with his audience, even when he was light years away. The figure takes another pull on his cancer stick, and his head is bathed in a holy nimbus of smoke. "You may have heard the official reports of the fall of the Confederacy of Man, and of the glorious rise of the empire called the Terran Dominion. And you may have listened to the stories of the coming of the aliens, the hordes of Zerg and the inhuman ethereal Protoss, of the battles of the Saras system and the fall of Tarsonis itself. You've heard the reports. As I said before, some of those reports had my name on them. Parts of them are even true." In the darkness beyond the light, someone shifts uneasily, unseen. The holographic projector lets out only stray bits of light, rogue photons, but the audience remains for the moment a mystery. Somewhere behind the darkness-shrouded audience, there is the sound of dripping water. "You read my words, then, and believe them. I'm here to tell you, in those broadcasts, that most of them were grade-A cow patties, massaged by the powers that be into more suitable and palatable forms. Lies were told, both small and large. Lies that have led us in part to our present sorry situation. A situation that is not going to improve unless we start talking about what really happened. What happened on Chausara, and Marsara, and Antigua Prime, and Tarsonis itself. What happened to me and some of my friends, and some enemies as well." The figure pauses, drawing itself up to its full height. It looks around, its sightless eyes sweeping the darkened room. It looks into the core of its audience's soul. "I'm Michael Daniel Liberty, I'm a reporter. Call this my most important, perhaps final report. Call this my manifesto. Call it what you will. I'm just here to tell you what really happened. I'm here to set the record straight. I'm here to tell you the truth. Chapter 1. The Press Gang. Before the war, things were different. Hell, back then, we were just making our daily living, doing our jobs, drawing our paychecks, and stabbing our fellow men and women in the back. We had no idea how bad things would get. We were fat and happy like maggots on a dead animal. There was enough sporadic violence, rebellions and revolutions, and balky colonial governments to keep the military going, but not enough to really threaten the lifestyles we had grown accustomed to. We were, in retrospect, fat and sassy. And if a real war broke out, well, it was the military's worry, the Marines' worry, not ours. The Liberty Manifesto. The city sprawled beneath Mike's feet like an overturned bucket of jade cockroaches. From the dizzying height of Handy Anderson's office, he could almost see the horizon between the taller buildings. The city reached that far, forming a jagged, spiked tear along the edge of the world. The city of Tarsonis, on the planet Tarsonis. The most important city on the most important planet of the Confederacy of Man. The city so great, they named it twice. The city so large, its suburbs had greater populations than some planets. A shining beacon of civilization, keeper of the memories of an Earth now lost to history, myth, and earlier generations. A sleeping dragon. And Michael Liberty could not resist twisting its tail.
"Come back from the edge there, Mickey," said Anderson.
The editor-in-chief was firmly ensconced at his desk, a desk as far away from the panoramic view as possible. Michael Liberty liked to think there was a note of concern in his boss's voice. "Don't worry," said Mike. "I'm not thinking of jumping." He suppressed a smile. Mike and the rest of the newsroom knew that the editor-in-chief was acrophobic but could not bear to surrender his stratospheric office view. So on the rare occasions when Liberty was summoned into his boss's office, he always stood near the window. Most of the time, he and the other drudges and news hacks worked way down on the fourth floor or in the broadcast booths in the building's basement.
"Jumping I'm not worried about," said Anderson. "Jumping I can handle. Jumping would solve a lot of my problems and give me a lead for tomorrow's edition. I'm more worried about some sniper taking you out from another building."
Liberty turned toward his boss. "Bloodstains that hard to get out of the carpet?"
"Part of it," said Anderson, smiling. "It's also a bitch to replace the glass."
Liberty took one last look at the traffic crawling far below and returned to the overstuffed chairs facing the desk. Anderson tried to be nonchalant, but Mike noted that the editor let out a long, slow breath as Mike moved away from the window. Michael Liberty settled himself into one of Anderson's chairs. The chairs were designed to look like normal furniture, but they were stuffed so that they sank an extra inch or two when someone sat down. This made the balding editor-in-chief with his comically oversized eyebrows look more imposing. Mike knew the trick, was not impressed, and set his feet up on the desk.
"So what's the beef?" the reporter asked.
"Have a cigar, Mickey."
Anderson motioned with an open palm toward a teak humidor. Mike hated being called Mickey. He touched his empty shirt pocket, where he normally stashed a pack of cigarettes.
"I'm on the wagon, trying to cut down."
"They're from beyond the Jandaran embargo," said Anderson temptingly. "Rolled on the thighs of cinnamon-shaded maidens."
Mike held up both hands and smiled broadly. Everyone knew that Anderson was too cheap to get anything beyond the standard El Ropos manufactured in some bootleg basement. But the smile was intended to reassure.
"What's the beef?" Mike repeated.
"You've really done it this time," said Anderson, sighing. Your series on the construction kickbacks on the new municipal hall.
Good stuff. The series should rattle a few cages.
They've already been rattled,
replied Anderson, his chin sinking down to touch his chest. This was known as the bearer of bad news position. It was something that Anderson had learned at some management course, but that made him look like a mating ledge pigeon.
Crap, thought Mike. He's going to spike the series. As if reading his thoughts, Anderson said,
Don't worry. We're going to run the rest of the series. It's solid reporting, well documented, and best of all, it's true. But you have to know you've made a few people very uncomfortable.
Mike mentally ran through the series. It had been one of his better ones, a classic involving a petty offender who was caught in the wrong place, a public park, at the wrong time, way after midnight, with the wrong thing, mildly radioactive construction waste from the municipal hall project. Said offender was more than willing to pass on the name of the man who sent him on this late-night escapade. That individual was, in turn, willing to tell Mike about some other interesting matters involving the new hall, and so forth, until Mike had, instead of a single story, a whole series about a huge network of graft and corruption that the Universe Network news audience ate up with their collective spoons. Mike mentally ran through the ward healers, low-level thugs, and members of the Tarsona City Council that he had skewered in print, discarding each in turn as a suspect. Any of those august individuals might want to take a shot at him, but such a threat wasn't enough to make Handy Anderson nervous. The editor-in-chief saw Mike's blank expression and added,
You've made a few powerful, venerable people very uncomfortable.
Mike's left eyebrow rose. Anderson was talking about one of the ruling families, the power behind the Confederacy for most of its existence, since those early days when the first colony ships, hell, prison ships, landed and or crashed on various planets in the sector. Somewhere in his reporting, he had nailed somebody with pull, or perhaps somebody close enough to one of the families to make the old venerables nervous. Mike resolved to go back over his notes and see what kind of linkages he could make. Perhaps a distaff cousin to one of the old families, or a black sheep, or maybe even a direct kickback. God knew that the old families ran things from behind the scenes since the year naught. If he could nail one of them. Mike wondered if he was visibly salivating at the prospect. In the meantime, Handy Anderson had risen from his seat and strolled around the side of his desk, perching on the corner nearest Mike. Another move directly out of the management lectures, Mike realized. Hell, Anderson had assigned him to cover those lectures once.
Mike, I want you to know you're on dangerous ground here.
Oh, God, he called me Mike, thought Liberty. Next, he'll be looking plaintively out the window as if lost in thought, wrestling with a momentous decision.
He said, I'm used to dangerous ground, boss.
I know. I just worry about those around you. Your sources, your friends, your co-workers.
Not to mention my superiors.
All of whom would be heartbroken if something horrible happened to you.
Particularly if they were standing nearby when it happened. Added the reporter. Anderson shrugged and stared plaintively out the full-length window. Mike realized that whatever Anderson was afraid of, it was worse than his fear of heights. And this was a man who, if office rumor was correct, and it was, kept a locked room in the sub-basement that contained dirt on most of the celebrities and important citizens of the city. The pause dragged beyond a moment into a minute. Finally, Mike broke. He gave a polite cough and said, So you have an idea how to handle this dangerous ground? Handy Anderson nodded slowly.
I want to print the series. It's good work.
But you don't want me anywhere in the immediate vicinity when the next part of that story hits the street.
I'm thinking of your own safety, Mickey. It's
Dangerous ground, finished Mike.
I heard.
Here be dragons.
Perhaps it would be time for an extended vacation.
Maybe a cabin in the mountains?
I was thinking more of a special assignment.
Of course, thought Mike.
That way, I won't have the chance to figure out whose tail I've inadvertently twisted and give those involved time to cover their tracks.
Another part of the Universe News Network empire?
Mike said with a broad smile, at the same time wondering what godforsaken colony world he would be doing agricultural reports from.
More of a roving reporter, teased Anderson.
How roving?
Mike's smile suddenly became flinty and brittle. Will I need shots for off-planet?
Better than getting shot for being on-planet. Sorry, bad joke. The answer is yes. I'm thinking definitely off-planet.
Come on, spill. Which hellhole do you want to hide me in?
I was thinking of the Confederate Marines. As a military reporter, of course.
What?
It would be a temporary posting, of course,
continued the editor.
Are you out of your mind?
Sort of. Our fighting men in space, battling against the various forces of rebellion that threaten our great confederacy. There are rumors that Arcturus Mengsk is rallying more support in the fringe worlds. Could turn really hot at any moment.
The Marines, sputtered Mike. The Confederate Marines are the biggest collection of criminals in the known universe outside of the Tarsona City Council.
Mike, please. Everyone has some criminal blood in them. Hell, all the planets of the Confederacy were settled by exiled convicts.
Yeah, but most people like to think we grew out of that. The Marines still make that one of their basic recruiting requirements. Hell, do you know how many of them have been brain-panned?
Nearly re-socialized, corrected Anderson. No more than 50% per unit these days, I understand. Less in some places. And the re-socialization is more often done with non-invasive procedures. You probably won't notice.
Yeah. And they pumped them so full of stimpaks they'd kill their own grandpas on the right command.
Exactly the sort of common misconception that your work can counter,
said Anderson, both eyebrows raised in practiced sincerity.
Look, most of the politicos I've met are naturally nuts. The Marines are nuts, and then they started messing with their heads. No, the Marines are not an option.
It'd make for some good stories. It'd probably get some good contacts.
No!
Reporters with experience with the military get perks, said the editor-in-chief. You get a green tag on your file, and that carries weight with the more venerable families of Tarsonas. In some cases, even forgiveness.
Sorry, not interested.
I'll give you your own column.
A pause.
Finally, Mike said, how big a column?
Full column page print, or 5 minutes stand-up for the broadcast. Under your byline, of course.
Regular?
You file, I fill.
Another pause.
A raise with that?
Anderson named a figure, and Mike nodded.
That's impressive, he said.
Not chump change,
agreed the editor-in-chief.
I'm a little old to be planet-hopping.
There's no real danger. And if something does flare up, there's combat pay automatic.
50% brain-panned? Mike asked.
If that.
Another pause.
Then Mike said, well, it sounds like a challenge.
And you're just the man for a challenge.
And it can't be worse than covering the Tarsona City Council.
Mike mused, feeling himself sliding down the slippery slope to acceptance.
My thoughts exactly,
his editor agreed.
And if it would help the network...
Yep, Mike thought. He was on the edge, poised to pitch over into the void.
You would be a shining light to us all, said Anderson. a well-paid shining light. Wave the flag a little, get some personal stories, ride around in a battle cruiser, play some cards. Don't worry about us back here at the office.
Cush posting?
Cushiest. I've got some pull, you know. Was an old green tag myself. 3 months' work, tops. A lifetime of rewards.
There was a final pause. A chasm as deep as the concrete canyon that yawned beyond the window. All right, said Mike. I'll do it.
Wonderful!
Anderson reached for the humidor, then caught himself and instead offered Mike his hand.
You won't regret it.
Why do I feel that I already do? Michael Liberty asked in a small voice as the editor's meaty, sweaty hand ensnared his own. Chapter 2. The Cush Posting. Service in the military, for those of you unfortunate enough never to have experienced it firsthand, consists of long periods of boredom, broken by mind-shredding threats to one's life and sanity. From what I can gather from the old tapes, it's always been like that. The best soldiers are those who can wake suddenly, react instantly, and aim precisely. Unfortunately, none of those traits are shared by the military intelligence that controls those soldiers. The Liberty Manifesto.
Mr. Liberty, said the perky murderess at the hatchway, the captain would like a word with you.
Michael Liberty, UNN reporter, assigned to the elite Alpha Squadron of the Confederate Marines, propped open one eye and found her, all smiles, standing next to his bunk. An all-night card game had just adjourned, and he was sure the young Marine lieutenant had waited until he had lain down before barging into his quarters. The reporter let out a deep sigh and said, "Does Colonel Duke expect me immediately?"
"No, sir," said the murderess, shaking her head for effect. "He said you should come at your leisure."
"Right," said Mike, swinging his legs over the edge of his bunk and shaking the temptation of sleep from his brain. For Colonel Duke, at your leisure usually meant within the next 10 minutes, damn it. Mike reached for his cigarettes, and only when his hand had dipped into the empty shirt pocket did he remember he had given them up. Filthy habit, anyway, he muttered to himself. To the Marine lieutenant, he said, need a shower. Coffee would be good, too. Lieutenant Emily Jameson Swallow, Liberty's personal assistant, liaison, minder, and spy for her military superiors, waited only long enough to determine that Mike was serious about getting up, then beetled off to the galley. Mike yawned, figured he must have had all of 5 minutes' sleep, stripped, and padded off to the sonic cleanser. The sonic cleanser was a military model, of course. This meant it was similar in construction to those high-pressure jets that blasted the meat off the bones at slaughterhouses. In the past 3 months, Mike had gotten used to it. In the past 3 months, Michael Liberty had gotten used to a lot of things. Handy Anderson had been true to his word. The posting was posh, or at least as posh as a military assignment could be. The NORAD II was a capital ship, one of the behemoth class, all neo-steel and laser turrets, as befitted the most legendary of Confederate military units, the Alpha Squadron. Alpha Squadron's primary mission was hunting rebels, particularly the Sons of Korhal, a revolutionary group under the bloodthirsty terrorist Arcturus Mengsk. Unfortunately, the Sons were never where they were supposed to be, and the NORAD II and her prized crew spent a lot of time showing the flag. A blue diagonal cross filled with white stars against a red background, the memory of a legend of old Earth, and keeping the local colonial governments in line. As a result, Mike's biggest challenge so far had been dealing with boredom and finding enough to write about to justify his column. The flag-waving propaganda came easy for the first few stories, but when there was a deficit of real action or achievement, Mike had to reach. A piece on Colonel Edmund Duke, of course.
Some human interest stuff on the well-oiled crew. A bit about the travails of the nearly re-socialized that Anderson scotched. Out of common decency, Handy explained. Local color on the various planets. Just enough to remind everyone, Handy Anderson in particular, that he was still alive and expected regular payments to his account. And then there was a long two-parter about the wonders of the Behemoth-class battlecruisers, a story that was decimated by military censors to a mere few paragraphs. Military secrets, it was explained. Like the sons of Korhal don't know what we have already, thought Mike as he slipped into his shorts and looked for a less rumpled shirt and pants. Hanging in his locker was a new traveling coat, a going-away present from the guys in the newsroom. It was a long duster that made him look like a denizen of the Old West, but the crew apparently felt that if Mike was going out to the interplanetary Styx, he might as well look the part. He slipped into some nondescript pants. Almost on cue, Swallow reappeared with a pot of Java and a mug. She poured as Mike buttoned up his shirt. The brew was military style A, freshly made and scalding, suitable for pouring down on peasants attacking the family castle. The coffee was another thing he had gotten used to. Of course, he had also gotten used to three squares, sufficient time to write his columns, and a flexible amount of privacy, as well as an ever-changing group of poker partners, all of whom were young, had no place to spend their paychecks, and could not bluff if their lives depended on it. He had even gotten used to Lieutenant Swallow, though her habitual positive attitude bothered him at first. He had expected some sort of minder, of course, some military attaché who would hang over his shoulder as he wrote and make sure he didn't do anything stupid, like drop his pen into the warp coils. But Lieutenant Emily Swallow was like something out of a training film. A particularly cheery training film, the type you show Mom and Dad before shipping their sons and daughters off to extended duty 5-star systems away. Hell, Lieutenant Emily Swallow looked like she wrote that type of training film. Small, petite, and always smiling, she seemed to take every request from Mike seriously, even if they both knew that there was a snowball's chance that it would be approved. She had no vices, except for the occasional cigarette, accepted with a smile and a guilty shrug. Further, when he hit her up for her own story, she demurred. Most of the crew were stoked up, talking about their lives back home, but Lieutenant Swallow instead just stopped smiling and ran her hand back along the side of her face, as if brushing away long hair that was no longer there. That was when Mike noticed the small divots behind her ear, the marks of the non-invasive neural resocialization that Anderson had mentioned. Yeah, she had been brain-panned, and good. No one could be that perky without an electrochemical lobotomy. Mike didn't bring up the subject again, but instead bribed one of the computer techs for some time with the personnel files. This cost him his 2 emergency packs of smokes, but by that time, he was through the worst of the cravings, and the coffin nails were better used in trade than consumption. He found out that before she had involuntarily joined the Marines, young Emily Swallow had the interesting hobby of attracting young men in bars, taking them to her home, tying them up, and flaying the skin and meat from their bones with a fillet knife. Most men would be disconcerted by this news, but Michael Liberty found it reassuring. The murderess of 10 young men on Halcyon was much more understandable than the smiling, gung-ho woman who looked like someone from a recruiting poster. Now, following her through the corridors of the NORAD 2 to the bridge, Mike wondered how Lieutenant Swallow felt about her medical incarceration and involuntary transformation. He decided that she just didn't dwell on it, and given her original nature, Mike decided not to press the issue. For a huge ship, the NORAD-2 had narrow passageways, built almost as an afterthought,
After all, the landing bays, wardrooms, weapon systems, galleys, computers, and other necessities had been piled in. In the hallways, oncoming traffic had to press against walls to pass. Mike noticed large arrows painted on the floor, which Lieutenant Swallow noted were for times when the ship was on alert and soldiers were in full battle armor. Mike realized that the gangways would have been made even narrower had they not been expected to accommodate men in powered combat suits. They passed several large bays where technicians were already pulling out wiring and cables. The scuttlebutt was that the NORAD-2 was due for an overhaul, including an upgrade with the Yamato cannon. Given the number of laser batteries, Wraith-class space fighters, and even the rumored nuclear arms carried on board, the huge spine-mounted cannon would be icing on the cake. In fact, this was what Mike expected Colonel Duke to tell him, that the NORAD-2 was going into dry dock for repairs, and he, Michael Liberty, would be on the next shuttle back to Tarsonis. That would make dealing with the old fossil almost worthwhile. He revised his opinion when they stepped onto the bridge, and Duke scowled at him. Mind you, Duke never looked particularly pleased to see a member of the press, but this was the deepest and most hostile scowl that Mike had seen yet.
"Mr. Liberty, reporting is requested, sir," said Lieutenant Swallow, with a salute as sharp as that in any recruiting video.
The colonel, decked out in his command brown uniform, said nothing, but pointed a stubby finger toward his ready room. Lieutenant Swallow led him there, then abandoned him for whatever tasks she did when she wasn't keeping tabs on him. Probably, Mike mused, something involving skinning puppies. Mike's initial concern grew deeper when he recognized the humanoid shape now hanging from a wall-mounted frame in the ready room. It was a powered combat suit. Not one of the standard-issue CMC-300s, but a command suit, fitted with its own portable comm system. Colonel Duke's suit, now shined and greased and ready for the great man to step into it. Mike was less sure now that they were going in for that Yamato refit. Most of the Marines kept their armor handy, and drills were as common as meals. Liberty managed to avoid that duty, as he was considered a soft target and wasn't cleared for the heavier suits. It was, however, amusing to see the rookies staggering around the narrow passages in full combat armor. But for the colonel's suit to be here, newly polished and ready, boded very ill indeed. The suit itself was massive, hunched forward on the hangar under its own weight. In that way, it seemed to Michael Liberty, the empty suit fit its owner well. Colonel Duke reminded Mike of the great apes of old Earth, the ones that climbed buildings and swatted down primitive aircraft. Gorillas. Duke was an old silverback, the pointy-headed leader of his tribe, and just the way he leaned forward inspired fear in his subordinates. Mike knew that Duke was from one of the old families, the original leaders of the Koprulu sector colonies, but he must have done something wrong along the way. Edmund Duke was obviously long overdue for his general's stars. Mike wondered what nasty incident stood in the way of his promotion, and surmised that it was loud, messy, and deeply buried in the Confederate military files. He wondered what type of pull it would take to get that information out, and if Handy Anderson had it in his not-so-secret vault. The door slid open and Colonel Duke strode in like a Goliath-style armored walker, scattering infantry units before it. His scowl was even deeper than earlier. He held down a hand to indicate that Mike shouldn't rise. Mike had no intention of doing so. Circled his wide desk and sat down. He rested his elbows on the polished obsidian desktop and templed his fingers in front of him.
"I trust, Liberty, you have had an enjoyable time with us," he asked.
He had the old, faint drawl that marked the elder families of the Confederacy.
Mike, who had not expected small talk, managed to stammer out a general affirmative.
"I am afraid it will not last," said the colonel. "Our original orders were to be relieved by the Theodore G. Bilbo, and to put in for a retrofit within 2 weeks. Events have now overtaken us."
Mike said nothing. He had been in enough briefings over the years, even on a civilian level, to know not to interrupt until he had something worth interrupting for.
"We are rerouting our course to the Sara system. The Confederacy has 2 colony worlds there, Marsara and Chausara. This is an extended patrol over and above our initial mission parameters."
Mike just nodded. The colonel was creeping up on the subject, acting like a dog with a chicken bone in its throat. Something he had a hard time swallowing and a worse time coughing back up. Mike waited.
"I must remind you that as a member of the press assigned to the Alpha Squadron, you are limited under the Confederate Military Code in regard to what your duties are and how you perform them."
"Yes, sir," said Mike, sternly enough to give the impression that he gave a rat's ass about the Confederate Military Code.
"And this extends to the current assignment as well as to future references to events that occur during your posting here."
Duke nodded his pointed head, clearly demanding a response. "Yes, sir." Mike separated the words clearly to underscore his comprehension. Another pause, during which Mike could feel the throbbing of the ship around him. Yes, the NORAD-2 was vibrating at a different pitch now, a bit higher, more intense, a bit more frantic. Men and women were preparing the ship for subwarp, and perhaps for combat? Mike suddenly wondered about the wisdom of skipping those combat suit drills. Colonel Edmund Duke, the dog with the chicken bone in his throat, said,
"You know our histories."
It was more of a statement than a question. Mike blinked, suddenly unsure how to respond. He settled for, "Sir?"
"How we came to the sector and settled it. Took it for our own," prompted the colonel.
"Aboard the sleeper ships, the supercarriers," Mike said, pulling up the lessons of childhood. "The Naglfar, the Argo, the Sarengo, and the Reagan. The crews of prisoners and outcasts of old Earth crashing onto a scattering of habitable worlds."
"And they found 3 such worlds right off the bat, and a double handful nearby that were terrestrial or close enough for army work. But they found no life."
Begging the colonel's pardon, but there was extensive native life on all 3 original planets. Plus, most of the colonies and fringe worlds have their own ecosystems. Terraforming often, but not always, eradicates native life forms. The colonel waved off the comment.
"But nothing smarter than your standard watchdog. Some big insects they domesticated on Umoja, and a lot of stuff that was burned when the world was settled and put under the plow. But nothing smart."
Mike nodded. Intelligent life has always been one of the mysteries of the universe. We have found world after world, but nothing to indicate that there is something else out there as smart as we are.
"Until now," said the colonel. "And you will be the first network reporter on the scene."
Mike warmed a bit to the subject. There have been numerous mysterious formations on many planets that indicate there might have been sentient life at one time. In addition, there are space haulers' tales of mysterious lights and Foo Fighters.
"These aren't lights in the sky or old ruins. This is living proof of E.T. activity, that we are not alone out here."
Duke let that sink in, and a smirk tugged at the side of his mouth. It did not improve his appearance in the least. Somewhere within the ship, a switch closed, and the monstrous engines began to hum. Mike stroked his chin and asked, "What do we know so far? Has there been an envoy, a representative, or Was this a chance discovery? Did we find a colony? Or was there a direct embassy? The colonel let out a gruff chortle.
Mr. Liberty, let me make myself quite clear. We have made contact with another alien civilization. This contact consisted of them vaporizing the colony of Chalsara. They burned it to the ground, and then burned the ground beneath it. We're going there now, but we don't know if the hostiles are still present. And you will be the first network reporter on the scene, repeated the colonel. Congratulations, son. Mike didn't feel very good about this particular honor.
Chapter 3. The Sara System. The first contact with another sentient race, and they blow up a planet. Hell of a calling card. Now, blowing up a planet is nothing new. Christ, we humans did it ourselves not too long ago. There was a revolt on the planet Korhal 4. The inhabitants didn't care much for the graft and corruption that was part and parcel of the Confederacy. They tried to rebel. At first, the Confederacy tried a soft approach. They took out the rebellion's leaders with assassins, ghost troopers with personal cloaking devices. Unsurprisingly, this approach just made the people of Korhal angrier and more rebellious, so the Confederacy took a harder line. We nuked Korhal 4 from orbit. Apocalypse-class missiles. About 1,000 of them. Some idiots on battlecruisers pressed a button, and 35 million people became nothing more than vapor, and their homes nothing more than a memory. Naturally, there were official justifications thereafter about the evil, menacing nature of Korhal, and how they were planning to do it to us if they even got the slightest chance. It was unfortunate that the proof of this accusation was located on a planet covered by blackened glass. I think that's what really scared the military about the vaporization of Chalsara, that there was something else out there that was just as crazy as we were, and they were better at it than we were. The Liberty Manifesto. Mike took advantage of the time the ship was in subwarp to pore through the open computer archives of the Sara system. The system had been found by a prospector before the Guild Wars, glommed onto by the Confederacy when it eclipsed that budding rival in space, and was, according to the ship's archives, the home of a growing pair of colony worlds. The only thing that made the Sara system different from about a dozen other similar systems was that there were two worlds in its habitable band, instead of just one. Chalsara was the smaller and more outlying of the worlds, and had the larger colony. It had been settled, in Confederate tradition, as a penal colony, and a lot of its now former inhabitants had still been serving hard time. Marsara had a more eclectic mix of former prospectors and soldiers, along with a couple of religious types that didn't agree with the Tarsonian limits of tolerance for other faiths. Both planets had rich potential for mineral exploitation, but of course the Confederacy had dibs on those resources. The locals would have to either work under Confederate contracts or flee to fringe worlds. Mike checked the current UNN reports. There was a small bit about a disruption of signals from the Sara system, but most of the broadcast was given over to the latest Sons of Korhal outrage, poison gas in a public plaza on Haji, and a multi-train monorail pileup on Moria. Mike composed a brief blurb, summarizing his discussion with Colonel Duke, and noting that he was under full military restrictions in future reporting. That meant that his report would be checked over before it left the ship, and then again before it was broadcast. Handy Anderson would be simultaneously griping about military censorship and dancing around his office in joy for the scoop. If I'm lucky, thought Mike, he'll dance too close to that damned window of his. Mike prepared a second report. This one scrambled under cipher software and burned onto a mini-disc. This one wasn't going anywhere. But if something happened to them and their bodies were found, someone would know what was going on. It was a grim insurance policy. He had just finished the second report when a large shadow blocked the light. Mike looked up into the face of Lieutenant Swallow, now a foot taller and several hundred pounds heavier. She was decked out in a combat suit, her natural strength boosted by servos and mechanisms. An empty belt clip at her side would soon be filled with an 8mm C-14 gauze rifle and impaler for when she went into action. Her visor was open, and she beamed an excited smile at him. She looked like a girl expecting her first prom dance.
"Sir, we'll be coming out of suborb soon. The colonel wants you on the bridge at the soonest possible moment."
Then she was gone. Meaning, right damned now, thought Mike, and followed Swallow out of his quarters. The passageways were no wider now, but with the bulky suits now in preponderance, they had become one way with movement guided by huge arrows on the floor. At several crossings, Swallow held up to let other crewmen pass in front of them, and Mike had the sudden feeling of being the only kindergartner in a sixth-grade class. "I've got to get me one of those suits," he commented.
"I was unaware you were trained in the CMC-powered combat suit, sir," said Swallow.
"I've read the manuals."
"That knowledge would be barely sufficient for your own protection in a crisis situation, sir. However, should something happen, it is my personal responsibility to make sure you get to safety."
"I'm filled with confidence." Mike smiled at Swallow's back, just in case she had a camera trained on him. The ship gave a trans-dimensional shudder, and the engine shifted back from subwarp. They were in Sara's space. The bridge was now bathed in red light, accented by the green monitors that lined the lower deck. Colonel Duke was decked out in his own battle armor. He looked like a gorilla at the court of King Arthur. A gorilla with a pointy head, wearing plate mail. He was surrounded by a small cluster of view screens, each with a different talking head feeding data to him.
"Mr. Liberty, reporting as requested, sir," said Swallow, managing another sharp salute, even in the heavy armor.
"Colonel," said Mike. Duke did not look away from the main screen. He simply said,
"We're nearing Chow Sara."
At first, Mike thought the main screen was malfunctioning. They were approaching Chow Sara from the night side. The large disk of the outer Saran world was a messy rainbow smear of light, like that found on oily water. Then Mike realized that this was the surface of Chow Sara he was looking at. It glowed with rippling bands of colors, moored at a handful of locations by bright spikes of orange.
"What?"
Mike blinked. "What did this?"
"First contact, Liberty," said the colonel. "First contact of the most extreme kind. How are the scans?"
One of the technicians reported,
"I get no life readings. Most of the surface area has been liquefied and sterilized. This zone looks to be between 20 and 50 feet deep."
"The settlements?" Mike asked. The technician continued,
"The orange spikes appear to be magma breaches through the planetary mantle. They are located at the locations of the known settlements."
A pause.
"Plus at least a dozen other locations."
Mike looked at the swirling, deadly rainbow on the screen. The sun was cresting the horizon ahead of them, and the world looked no better in the sunlight. Only a few dark clouds, thin as crow feathers, dragged across the sunlight side.
"In addition, 80% of the atmosphere has been blown off in the attack," continued the technician.
"Any orbital presence?" asked Duke,
an armor-plated monolith in their midst.
"Working,"
said the tech. Finally came the response.
"Negative. Nothing of ours. Nothing of unknown origin, either. There may be some fragments on a larger scan."
"Widen the scan," said Duke. "I want to know if there's anything out there. Ours or theirs?"
"Working. Definite fragments. Likely ours. Would need a salvage team to confirm."
"Why did they do this?" Mike asked, but no one answered him. Techs in lighter weight combat suits tapped displays with gauntleted hands, and the numerous heads on the screens all talked at once to Colonel Duke. Finally, Mike came up with a question he thought they could answer. What did this? Nukes? The words seemed to break Duke from his steady stream of information. He looked at the reporter.
Atomic delivery systems leave blackened glass and burning forests. Even Core Hall had some surviving pockets of clear terrain for a while, at least. Chaosara has been burned down to the liquid core in places. This is much more deadly than even apocalypse bombs. This, Duke pointed at the screen, is the work of an alien race, the Protoss. From what I'm being told, they warped in from nowhere, closer to the planet than we would ever attempt. Huge ships, and a lot of them. Caught a few transports and scavenger ships and blew them out of the sky. Then they unleashed whatever it was on the planet and sterilized it like a 3-minute egg. Then they left again. Marsara's on the other side of the sun right now, and they're in a panic that they might be next.
Protoss. Mike shook his head slightly, digesting the data. Something was wrong here. He looked at the text display, showing the deep radar holes, punching down to the planet's magma.
You have enough for your report, Mr. Liberty, Duke said. We will remain on station in the event of other hostiles for the foreseeable future. You may mention in any report you file that we will be joined by the Jackson 5 and the Huey Long within days.
The tech reached for his ear, then said,
Sir, we have anomalous readings.
Location, snapped the colonel, turning away from Liberty.
Z2 Quadrant 5, 1 AU out. Numerous anomalies.
Baron,
working.
A pause, and then a defeated shrug crept into the tech's words.
Heading for Marsara, sir.
Duke nodded.
Prepare to intercept anomalous readings. Launch fighters when in range.
Mike spoke before he thought.
Are you crazy?
Duke turned back to the reporter.
That was a rhetorical question, I hope, son.
We're one ship.
We're the only ship between them and Marsara. We will intercept.
Mike almost said, easy for you, you're in a hard-shelled battle suit, but caught himself. Whatever could go through a planetary crust wouldn't be stopped by a few layers of combat armor. Instead, Mike took a deep breath and just gripped the railing, as if he were hoping that this might ease the eventual blow.
Approaching visual, said the tech. Putting on screen.
The main screen flickered to reveal a scattering of fireflies against the night sky. They looked almost pretty against the darkness. Then Mike realized that there were hundreds of them, and that these were only the main ships. Smaller gnats danced around them.
Are we within launching range for the raids?
The colonel asked.
Mark it 2 minutes, replied the tech.
Launch as soon as possible.
Mike took a deep breath and wished that he had joined in the combat suit drills after all. Even at long range, the Protoss ships had form and definition. The largest were huge cylindrical creations, similar in appearance to luminous zeppelins. They were surrounded by hungry moths, and Mike realized these had to be their fighters, their equivalents of the A-17 wraiths that were now in the hangars, just waiting for them to close to within striking range. Other golden ships danced between the larger carriers, glimmering like small stars. Then, as Mike watched, one of the great carriers seemed to dissolve. There was a flash of light, a soft glowing, and then it was gone. Another moment and another flash and another disappearance.
Sir,
said the technician.
Anomalous reading disappearing.
Cloaking technology? Asked the colonel.
Despite himself, Mike said, at this scale?
Working!
A huge pause, as deep as a canyon.
Negative! It appears that they are surrounding themselves with some sort of subwarp field. They are retreating.
As Mike watched, more of the ships began to flash and vanish. The great carriers and their brood of smaller ships, the lesser golden vessels, all vanished, like fey spirits with the coming of dawn. Fey spirits that can burn a planet down to its molten core, Mike reminded himself. The colonel allowed himself a smile.
Good. They're afraid of us. Have all stations stand down, but remain alert for a trick.
Mike shook his head. This makes no sense. They have the power to toast a planet. Why are they afraid of us?
Obvious, said the colonel. They're spent. They don't have enough force to engage us.
We're only one ship. Mike shook his head angrily. There were dozens out there.
They fear possible reinforcements.
No, no. Something's going on here. It doesn't make human sense.
We're not dealing with humans here, said Duke, scowling. Look at their firepower.
Exactly. These Protoss have superior numbers and firepower, and we're facing them down? Why are they here?
Mr. Liberty, that will be enough questions for the day.
The scowl deepened, but Mike ignored the warning. No, something's not Jake in all this. Look at the damage reports. Mike pointed at one of the tech's monitors. They cooked an entire planet, but some places deeper than others. Every major human city, yes. But look. Mike pointed at the wall of data. There are strike zones on the other side of the planet, far away from any recorded human settlement.
I know.
I was just checking the archives.
I said that will be enough, mister. We have more to worry about with the Protoss than just how effective they are in choosing their targets.
Mike's face lit up as a connection was made deep in his brain. And where did we get the name Protoss, Colonel? Is that ours or theirs?
Mr. Liberty!
Color was creeping up the sides of Duke's face. And if it's their name for themselves, how come we know it? Didn't we have to know it in advance? The reporter was raising his voice now, the way he would for a dissembling candidate in a precinct by-election.
Lieutenant Swallow!
Duke bit off the command.
Yes, sir.
Another perfect salute.
Escort Mr. Liberty off the bridge. Now!
Mike gripped the railing firmly with both hands. A ligatured arm wrapped in metal snaked around his waist. Mike was shouting now.
Damn it, Duke! You know more than you're telling! This stinks to high heaven!
I said now, Lieutenant!
Duke snarled.
This way, sir,
said Swallow, breaking Mike's hold and pulling the reporter off his feet. With her prize, she retreated for the lift. Still shouting questions, Michael Liberty left the bridge. The last thing he heard before the doors slid shut was Colonel Duke ordering the opening of a comm line with the colonial magistrate of Marsara. Chapter 4. Down on Marsara. There's a period in any war between the first blow and the second. It's quite a moment, an almost tranquil time, when the realization of what has happened is just sinking in, and everyone feels like they know what happens next. Some prepare to flee, some prepare to hit back, but no one moves. Not yet. It's a perfect moment, the time when the ball is at the highest point of the throw. The action has been taken, and for one frozen moment everything is moving, but everything is at rest. Then there are those jackasses who can't leave such things alone, and the ball starts downward again. The second blow is thrown, and we plunge into the maelstrom. The Liberty Manifesto. Michael Liberty was not allowed out of his quarters for the remainder of the action over Marsara. Lieutenant Swallow, or one of her neurally resocialized comrades, stood guard outside his quarters for the next 2 days. After that,
It was an escort to the dropship to beautiful Marisara itself. Now, a day after that, he was in the press pool, fleecing the local reporters for most of their life savings while waiting for something that resembled a straight answer from the powers that be. It was not forthcoming. The official debriefings were pre-shaped pellets of non-news that stressed the suddenness of the attack on Chausara, hailed Duke and the NORAD II crew as heroes for standing up to the enemy, and claimed that only the ever-watchful vigilance of the Confederacy could protect Marisara. The Protoss, still no idea where the name came from, were portrayed as cowards who folded at the first sign of a real fight. The delicate if impressive nature of their lightning-charged ships confirmed that notion. They fled because they were afraid to be hit. That was the story, anyway, and the Marines were sticking with it. In fact, if anyone in the press pool wandered too far from the official version, their reports suddenly started getting lost in transmission. That kept most of the locals in line. They were all issued passes with barcodes that were supposed to be presented upon demand, and Mike knew to keep tabs on their whereabouts. All of the other news hounds knew Liberty's story from aboard the NORAD II, but no one had yet tried to use any of the information in their own reports. In the outside world, a planetary lockdown was in force. Officially, a civilian protection measure, to quote the official press release, it was effectively a military overthrow of the local government. The locals were being herded into concentration points for supposedly easier evacuation. No mention was made of where the evacuating ships would come from, or even if there was a timetable for abandoning the planet. In the meantime, there were Marine patrols on every corner, and those citizens who remained in the city were looking very, very nervous. In the absence of anything reportable, the news hounds hung out at the large cafe in front of the Grand Hotel, played cards, waited for the next official news-like release, and speculated madly. Mike, bedecked in his duster, lounged with them, looking more like a native than any of the others.
"Man, I don't think there are any aliens at all," said Rourke between hands of poker.
Rourke was a big redhead with a craggy scar across his forehead.
"I think the Sons of Korhal finally found enough tech to avenge the nuking of their homeworld."
"Bite your tongue," said Mags, a crusty old bird from one of the local dailies. "Even joking about the Korhals is enough to get you shot."
"So you have a theory, man?" countered Rourke.
"They're human, but not our type of human," said the old reporter. "They're from old Earth. I figured that while we were gone, they got so wrapped up in genetic purity and such that they are nothing but clones now, and that they've come after us to clear out the rest of the race."
Rourke nodded. "I heard that one. And Thaddeus from the Post thinks they're robots, and they have some programming that prevents them from defending themselves. That's why they booked out when the NORAD took them on."
"You're all wrong,"
said Murray, a stringer from one of the religious networks.
"They're angels, and Judgment Day has arrived."
Both Rourke and Mags made derisive noises. Then Rourke said,
"What about you, Liberty? What do you think they are?"
"All I know is what I saw," Mike said. "And what I saw was that whatever they are, they liquefied the surface of the planet next door, and they could be here faster than the Confederacy could react. And we're here at Ground Zero playing cards." A pall hung over the table for a moment, and even Murray, the holy stringer, was quiet. Finally, Rourke let out a long breath and said,
"You Tarsonis boys sure know how to squelch a good party. You in or out for the next deal?"
Mike suddenly sat up, staring intently out into the road. Despite themselves, Murray and Rourke swiveled in their chairs but could see only the usual handful of Marines in the street, some in combat armor, some in regulation uniform. "Quick, Rourke, Give me your press credentials, Mike said. The big redhead instinctively grabbed the tags around his neck as though they were a life preserver.
No way, man!
Okay, then let me trade my credentials for yours. Mike held out his own Marine-issued ID.
How come?
Rourke asked, already pulling the chain off over his head.
Your local press, Mike said. They'll let you out of the cordon into the hinterland.
Yeah, but anything I put down goes through the censors anyway, the big man protested, handing over the tags. Nothing gets out of here.
Yeah, but I'm going to go